Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spearco with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. In fact, you know, after 16 and a half years of saying that, it just kind of occurs to me that on some days it's not one man's view. It's multiple people's view. On an interview show, it's two at least. And, well, on days like this, it's about six because we've got the expert counsel lined up. We're going to hear from two men today. House Republicans thumb their noses at Doge, Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams. I've been saying this all week and getting attacked by the same people who cheered me on for the last month with Orange Man for saying, hey, the only Republican in Congress who's actually acting the way Republicans talk right now is Thomas Massie. They all want to get rid of Thomas Massie now because he had the audacity to vote against something that was basically a Republican omnibus that grows our deficit and our debt by trillions of dollars and vote against it because supposedly we're supposed to cut government. But now they all want to skin him because, well, Orange Man wants the omnibus, even though they're not calling it an omnibus. We'll talk about that as a follow-up to what Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams have to say. Mike Melito will talk about choosing optics for an AR-10. Joel Riles will talk about not getting frustrated when you're trading a dog. And this is kicking off a four-part series from Joel on the issues that dog trainers tend to have where they get bad results. I think this will be a great series, and I'll try to run one a week as long as things don't kind of jack that plan up because he's designed this as a four-part series. Mick Ferguson will talk about not using certain things to amend soil, which I'll agree with, and how to sex mulberries. Did you know mulberries, at least certain mulberries, actually have male and female trees? It's not quite that cut and dry, but it also kind of is. Carrie Brown will talk about gathering and using something called old man's beard. It gets treated like an herb. It's really a lichen, though, right? So it's a really useful thing, though, in the world of medicinal things. It's not everywhere, but if you live where it is, this is a good time to gather it. Ken Daniels will talk about something called Miracle Berry and how you can use it to hack your taste buds. You know, this is something I've known about for as long as I've done this show, maybe a little bit longer. I first discovered this plant in a Raintree nursery catalog, and it was one of those things when I looked into growing it, it won't survive a frost, and I just decided it wasn't worth trying to grow. Maybe I need to be growing this, and it's something like, you know, like you can do with citrus in the South. You put it on casters in a big pot and bring it in when it freezes. Because I want to use this now, and I have a link after his segment to where you can buy it as a tablet, but it's kind of expensive. What is it? What does it do? You'll find out when Ken talks about it. And then for my anchor segment today, I actually had a choice of four that I was going to do today, all over the place, mostly socio-political topics. I put it out on X for a one-hour poll today, and overwhelmingly, the one that won is something I was planning on doing a whole show over, but I don't know if it really warrants more than just, at this point in time anyway, a 10-minute segment. There's a massive political divide rising in Gen Z. You know, we tend to, especially those of us who are in our 50s, late 40s to mid-50s, and then you get into the boomer generation, that whole group tends to kind of pick on the younger generation. But I also remember when the millennials were the younger generation, Gen Z was coming up, I kept hearing people say, like, they're going to be the most conservative generation in history. I'm like, I don't know. Well, what if I told you it's both woke and conservative? And I know that all the generations have their factions of it, but Gen Z is dividing in a very unique way. It has always been the case that women are generally more liberal than men and men more conservative than women. But I believe there's a socio-dynamic that actually causes that in that men do all the hard work. Now, I know some of you women are getting really mad at me when I do this segment today. When I say hard work, I mean physically demanding work. Not that you have to be smart to do it. Not that you have to be good to do it. I mean the physically demanding, ass-breaking, blue-collar work that most of the men that do it would prefer not to do. let alone women doing it. I know there's women that do it, and I know there's women that are conservative, and you have to calm the F down today for this segment to make sense. We're talking about generalities here, which means if you had a million people and 80% of them did a thing a certain way or tended to that direction, that would still be that you had 200,000 that didn't. But you would, no statistician would ever say that that's not a that's not something you can generalize. Well, when you look at it that way, when you generalize that way, Gen Z men who are now in their early 20s to mid 20s, I know it's hard to keep up as we age, but those men are by and large generally breaking hard right conservative. Now, hard right tends to mean in people's little tiny minds today, Nazi. It doesn't mean anything like that. The Nazis were socialists, by the way. Authoritarian, nationalist, socialists. So they were actually national lefties, is what they really were, versus global lefties, which commies are. The females in Gen Z, though, are breaking very hard liberal, much harder than even, like, liberal millennials, going full on woke to the absurd. And this is an issue. Most people tend to marry, partner with people about their age, somewhere in their generation. If they're at the edge of a generation, they tend to gravitate toward the edge of, you know, their own generation or the edge of the next generation up. But you don't have a lot of people running around who have 20-year spreads in a marriage. It happens, but again, we generalize here. You're usually within 5 years of each other on average. But what happens when you have men that are like, no, F that, and women that are like, no, let's embrace that, in the same generation, in the same demographic cohort? And while this has always been an issue, like I said, women tend to drift more liberal and men more conservative, they were also tending up until recently to be somewhere toward the center in general, so there was enough pairings that would work. So it was not very uncommon for a man and a woman to maybe vote differently or whatever, but they were close enough that it wasn't a real problem in their relationship. And men have tended to just kind of, okay, fine, whatever. And then they go do whatever they're going to do anyway. It doesn't change the way they think, but they've been willing to placate women in their lives because women have a certain sort of control over men to a degree. What happens when that breaks? What happens when you have like 20% of women that are center to center right to right and 80% that are center left to uber woke liberal, and you have the exact opposite break in men? And then the men that don't break right are not really interested in women, if you get my drift. Well, we could have, instead of a baby boom generation, is this the beginning of a baby plop, as in no babies generation, or very few babies generation? We will see. But we're going to talk about how that might actually impact our future. And one of the other subjects I had brought up today was the college enrollment cliff hitting. And I think this is going to aggravate the situation. We may actually do a show someday where we take like three of the four topics I had today and put them all together in one show. Today we're just going to talk about this one aspect, and I do think it's something to be looking at. Either you're in that generation, it directly affects you. You're younger and you're not listening to this show. If you're a Gen Alpha, you probably don't listen to this show right now because the youngest Zs are still really young. And if you're an Xer or a Boomer, this is the generation we're going to depend on to take care of us in our old age. When all of us Gen Xers are sitting in old folks' homes fighting each other with Metallica and Led Zeppelin shirts on and shit, right, and beating each other with canes, the people we're going to be depending on to take care of us are these people. Are they even going to be there? Is there going to be a replacement generation coming? Are we about to see a global decline as has been prophesied for a long time? We might, and this might be one of the major aggravating circumstances in it. And whether you believe it or not, it is going to matter. Even if you're old, it may not matter to you, but it will matter to those you leave behind. Or will Gen Z men be the salvation of humanity? Is that possible? I'm going to come at this from an angle today that you might agree, yes, it's not only possible, it is also probable. With that, before we get into our first segment today, Let's go ahead and remind you guys one of the ways you can help support this show. It's really easy to do. Just do your online shopping at tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Go there before you do your online shopping. No matter what you buy, you help us out. I only had two items of the day this week. I haven't added one today. The AeroPress coffee maker is my item of the day today. It is a fantastic tool. I believe if you give it a shot, especially if you have a good grinder that can grind to a fine grind, you are probably not going to want to use much else to make coffee with, unless you're investing in like one of them really expensive, like $500 espresso machines. What this little plastic tool does is absolutely amazing from a quality standpoint and a flexibility standpoint, and then an ease of cleaning. You know, it takes me a minute or so to clean a French press, and it takes a little bit longer than that to do a really good job on it. And every once in a while, I got to take apart the metal screening and rinse that and that. You know, maybe it goes in a dishwasher. It takes me literally 20 seconds. I timed myself this morning, 20 seconds to completely clean the AeroPress after making a cup of coffee with it. With that, let's go ahead and dive on into it. Let's hear from Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams on how the Republican Congress, it's all about cutting government. Well, they're just thumbing their nose at that actual idea.
The last month or so, we've heard about DOGE. We've heard about all this massive waste that has been in the, has just rot just below the surface of government. How disgusting it is. The things that are being paid, the people that are getting rich for doing terrible things with our money. And they have basically given the Americans the appetite for, let's cut this out. This is awful. This is a cancer. So this is the first test, and as you say, I wouldn't want to be Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House. He has to put something up that will pass. However, when you look at what was passed and who held out, I would say that this is not a day to cheer necessarily if you like what DOGE is doing. Now, the thing that that struck me looking at this, Dr. Paul, is now I didn't follow budget stuff that closely when I worked for you on the Hill. That was Norm and Paul Martin and all those guys. But I do remember overhearing over and over again the phrases, this is going to be a real cutting budget. It's going to reduce the pace of increase. Remember that? Reduce the pace of increase. The other one is, yeah, we're going to spend a little bit more for a few years, but then 5 years down the road, some cuts will kick in. Honest. Trust us. And the other one, which was an absolute gimmick, was, okay, but with every spending bill, you have to put a little note saying where in the Constitution this is authorized. Remember that? You've talked about that on the show. All of the smoke and mirrors gimmick to get a big budget passed, and that's what they've done.
And yet, if you look at the curves, government growth,
yeah,
government spending, penalty to the middle class, because most taxes are collected as a regressive tax through the destruction and the value of the dollar.
Yes.
Not many people talk about that, but it really is dumped on the middle class.
Well, let's look at what we're talking about. Now, this is the Hedge write-up. There's plenty of others out there, Politico and what have you. House passes GOP budget despite midday revolt. There were a handful of Republicans who didn't like conservative hardliners, who didn't like what happened. They got a phone call from the president. They got a little bit of a, you know how this works, Dr. Paul. They bring you in the room. They try to strong arm you. They try to grab you by the shirt and tell you you better do it or the world's going to end. Well, everyone peeled away except for one. Now go to that next clip. There's only one who refused to be bullied by the machine into betraying his principles. And that is, as we know, Thomas Massey. And here's the final vote. 217 Republican yeses. One Republican no. That I'm sure that looks familiar to you, Dr. Paul, and Thomas Massey's comment when he reposted the final vote, I do not cave. And that is a great point. So hats off again. This is the Thomas Massey week. We're going to give him another hats off for what he did.
Do you think he worries about the next election? He just had an election, didn't
he? Did.
And I think his people liked him.
Yeah, yeah, they do. He's become a real hero.
For sure.
So I agree with that. Here's my add-on. The Republicans are playing the same absolute smelly, stinking bullshit game that Democrats play all the time with these bills right now. So what they put out was Thomas Massey and all the Democrats, who, by the way, the Democrats and Thomas Massey voted no for totally divergent reasons here. But here's what they said. All of them voted no on no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, and no tax on Social Security. They all did that. This is like they voted no on giving flowers to orphans in the Flowers for Orphans bill, which the orphans bill gave one flower to one orphan and then sent $90 billion to Ukraine. It's the same game. Let me explain how this works. The bill that was passed is 80 pages. It's not that hard to read. It's not 9,000 pages. It doesn't actually say a lot of what the money does. It just says, here's how much money there's going to be, and here's the macro departments into which it goes. So I took this bill, and I just opened up the PDF in a browser, and I hit Command F on my Mac, which would be Control F on your PC. And I started typing, and I typed the word overtime into the search box. And you know how many instances of the word overtime that I found? None. Zero. Not one fucking mess, not one mention of overtime in the bill. Not one. Zero. Right? So then I was like, well, it's also supposed to be no tax on tips. So I typed tips into the search box, and I found not one fucking mention of the word tips in the bill. You can look this up yourself. So then I said, well, maybe they did at least say no tax on Social Security. So I typed Social Security and found two mentions of the word Social Security there. But when I looked at them, they had nothing to do with taxation on Social Security. So the bill that they passed, so they just said Thomas Massie voted against no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, and no tax on Social Security, and so did every other Democrat, doesn't say a single fucking word about that. Now, here's the spin from the Republican GOP scumbag rhino pieces of shit, just to be clear at how fed up with these people I am, okay? And no, I'm not carrying water for the Republicans like some of you retards think I am, okay? It paves the way to do it eventually. In other words, there's a promise from government here that if you let us do this, we will also do that. How often has that worked out? Now, here's what I'm going to say. There is actually a probability, not just a possibility, a probability that eventually there will be the other side of this bill come out after reconciliation. And it may actually do those three things. But nobody that voted against that because it wasn't in there. It's a lie. It's not a spin. It is a blatant 100% bullshit lie. There is nothing in this bill that actually obligates the government to do a single one of those things. Because people were putting out spins from like AI saying that it did, I just decided I can read 80 pages. I can give my audience that. I'm pretty fast at reading. So I read the whole fucking bill from one end to the other. There is nothing. All of the supposed it clears the way, it allows for it, whatever, all of that is just coming from mouths and secondary information. And this is something you need to understand when it comes to government, contracts, all of those things. A document says what it says, and it doesn't say what it doesn't say. And everybody saying it that's a Republican right now can even mean it, and it still doesn't mean anything. A promise from the government, if you want to know the value of that, go find an Indian reservation and talk to some of the people that live there about what a promise from the government means. A promise from the government and $7 will buy you a shitty coffee. That's what you can get. A shitty, sticky, sweetened milkshake coffee from Starbucks. That's what you get. Promise from government plus $7. Anyway, let's go on to something a little bit different. Let's talk about putting optics on an AR-10 and chill my blood pressure a bit.
What is going on, TSP? When it rains, it pours. You guys came through with some gun questions. Several this week. Some of which, the people did not want me to use their real name. Fair enough, Secret Squirrel. Let's get into this. What range magnification would be good for a scope for a DPMS LR-308? More. I've got a DPMS LR-308, basically an AR-10. Of the DPMS SR-25 pattern that has a scope designed for an AR-15. The scope has bullet drop built in 223 and 308, have similar ballistics with standard loads. It's FFP, and it's 2.5 to 10x. I would think it would be better to have something with more magnification. Well, sir, I disagree. I do not think so. 10x is plenty. In all my years of doing tactical stuff and hunting and guiding, I've never, ever seen anybody need more than 10x. But I've often often seen people need less than what magnification they had. There is no free lunch. The more you magnify the size of the target, the more you also magnify your movement. And it also makes it slower to acquire your target. That's just how it works. If I were you, I would look for lower magnification. There are a few 1 to 10Xs on the market now. I would rather have a 1 to 10 than anything higher power than that if you were looking for a different optic. A true 1 power is really nice. It's not as fast as a red dot. It's not as forgiving as far as, you know, eye box and stuff goes, but it's pretty fast. Can rock it with both eyes open. I don't think I have to tell you for any kind of tactical scenario why that's a good idea. The only time I like more than that 10x magnification is if I'm doing varmint hunting, which doesn't seem to be the application here. If I'm trying to shoot a prairie dog in the face at several hundred yards, that's a really tiny target. It takes me a while. It's not a big deal because another one's probably going to pop up. I don't want to misrepresent myself here. I've never been a sniper. I have been a designated marksman in real life. I was the commander of a tactical team to stop active shooters. On my designated marksman rifle, I rolled an LPVO, low power variable optic. If you want the 10X, I would say get a LPVO that has that. I'd even prefer 1 to 4, 1 to 6. On the bullet drop compensators, it is a very, very, very good day when those hash marks actually line up. Those are rough guesstimations. So I hope that you are not counting on those to actually make hits if you don't have the dope, the data obtained during previous engagements. If you're not out there shooting targets, you know, 200, 300, 400, 500, 600 yards away, and know that, oh, you know, to actually put the hash mark at 300 yards over the head of the target, and then I'll hit dead on. And at 5, I have to do the opposite and aim under, or, you know, vice versa. There's so many factors that go into that. Your rifle, the bore size of your rifle, the kind of rifling your rifle has, your barrel length. The scope manufacturers en masse have no idea what you're going to put that on. Those are rough estimates. So make sure you verify that. Get a good dope card. Tape it to the stock of your rifle. Keep in mind also that although it's so hot right now to shoot steel on a long range, and I get that. I literally live on a several thousand yard range. Steel targets don't move, and they're not trying to hide. Again, often in real life, you want the speed and the less complication over the higher magnification, slower, more movement. If you need more magnification for positive identification, PID, then get a good pair of binos. You're talking about a 308, you're going to start petering out 800 to 1,000 yards, maybe a little bit farther, and 10X is plenty for that. I would go opposite of what you asked. I would go lower on the low end, not higher on the high end. Just a side tip for other people listening there. Shoot with both eyes open. Shoot with both eyes open. Shoot with both eyes open. You can shoot both eyes open with a magnified optic. Did it all the time in the Marine Corps with an ACOG. It's called the Binden concept. People find it easier than others. But practice it. Shoot with both eyes open. I don't think I have to tell you why getting rid of a giant chunk of your peripheral vision is a bad idea. Not to mention that even when I shot like precision rifle and competed, we were told to shoot with both eyes open because in long strings of fire, it's unnatural to have one eye closed. It's fatiguing. So even with a magnified optic, learn to shoot with both eyes open. But it's easier with a one power optic. If you want a couple of options for that good LPVO, Trigicon makes a real good one. SIG also makes a 1 to 10. Vortex, I believe, also makes a 1 to 10, although I'm not recommending that one. I don't have any experience with that optic in particular. I've only ever used the like lower budget Vortexes, and I've not been impressed. Your best value is probably going to be the SIG, and I have some experience with that SIG 1 to 10, and it's a pretty good optic, and it's not going to make you mortgage your house. Now, that's my realistic advice. I give that totally understanding. You may not take it. For other people out there listening, looking for a good optic on a AR-10 type rifle, you asked about the Night Force 4-14. Night Force is an awesome optics company. There's nothing wrong with that optic. So if you want me to reinforce what you've already decided, that's fantastic. Also, Leupold makes a Mark III HD 4-12, an illuminated fire dot reticle. MSRP on that on their website is like $699. They also make in their VX5 a 3-15, which gives you one lower and one higher for your magnification, with a couple of different options for reticles ranging from, you know, just under $1,300 to just under $1,500. To give you and the other listeners that might be interested in a similar topic some other options. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Jack, for having me on again, and have a blessed day.
I agree so much with everything that Mike said. If you could kiss an audiophile, I would. I think over-magnification desires are one of the biggest mistakes that all gun owners. I don't care if you're using a 30-06 to shoot a deer, an AR-10 and a, you know, to be prepared for combat. I don't care what it is. Here's a reality, too, about the AR, M4, M16, call it whatever the hell you want to, platforms, right? They're incredibly easy to shoot well for their intended purpose, which is to make people dead, or at least severely wounded. When I was a kid in the military, when I went to basic training, I thought I really knew how to shoot a gun, and I was good, okay? But I had never shot at that kind of distance with iron sights, and I had really not shot much of anything with, an aperture, a peep sight, whatever you want to call it. I'd always used, you know, open sights meant, you know, like a buckhorn style or something like that. And it took me a little bit to just trust what the drill sergeant said and do what they said, but I found that hitting targets at 250 meters that were, you know, a pop-up target like you shoot in the military, you're talking about the size of basically an average-sized man with no arms from about his belly button to the top of his head. That's what those silhouettes that we would shoot at that distance were like. It wasn't even hard to hit them. It wasn't even hard to hit that target at that range. The only reason it was even somewhat difficult for me to hit a target at 300 meters with that same system, with a 223, not even 308, was that I knew enough about the military that I hid my glasses, and my drill sergeant didn't know that I wore glasses, and I had to do it without glasses. So you guys are, well, I need more magnification because my old eyes. Stop that shit. I'm so tired of hearing that from people. I guarantee you that most of you that say that, my right eye, at 18 years of age, probably had worse vision than whatever corrected vision you have in your dominant eye right now. And I was able to do that. I think this idea that we need more than what he said about when you magnify, when you increase your magnification of the target, you also magnify your movement is completely true. I've talked about that many times. And you reduce your field of view. There is no need for a rifle that you're going to shoot, let's say, with a maximum range that you would use on game or something like that, to ever go beyond, I'm going to say, absolute maximum of 6 power. Now, I'm not saying if you have a 3x9, I hate you. I don't know. That's the most common scope that there is, and they're, because of volume, economy of scale, they're the most affordable relative to their quality. That's fine. But you know what my go-to, like, if I could have one set magnification across all scope types, across all rifles, honest to God, I'm a little bit, I like a little magnification, 1.5, 1.5 to 5, or like 1.5 to 6, somewhere in that range. Somewhere in that range is where I would want to be. Because with a 1.5 optic, you get a little bit of magnification, but you can still, if you drill how to quickly acquire a target, you can acquire even close-range targets really, really quick in a 1.5 optic. If I can get a 1.25, I'll do it. There's just not a lot of optics that offer a variable optic that offers that. I'm not huge on red dots and things like that. I understand why some people are, and I do not say you're wrong if you do it. I like either irons or a low mag optic. I have had guns that I have put a lot of money and time into with like a 24 power scope on it. And if you're sitting on a sandbag, it's pretty cool to be able to see that way at, let's say, 300 yards. From a practical standpoint and application, it's like game hunting. Unless you're doing like extreme long range shit, you just don't need it. You just don't. I'll tell you one quick story before we go to the next segment. When I was a kid, I'm talking like 14, probably 14 years old, maybe 15. It was probably 15. I was out hunting on the farms, and I ended up having to walk across this field to get to another tree line. And as I'm walking across the tree line, I hear a shot literally go over my head. Now, I have nothing against the man that did it. He couldn't see me, and I was in no danger. I was down in a deep valley, and he was shooting basically from one high spot to another high spot. And it was the first time in my life I ever heard the sound of a round go over my head, heard the impact of the round, and then heard the shot. That's how far this dude was out. He was an old Korean War vet. He had a busted-ass old 760 Remington pump action in .30-06. And because that shot was fired, I kind of waited to see what was going to happen. And the next, I see this orange dot come over the hill and this old man walking. When he got to me, he was at 330 paces. And he said he got his deer. I went with him to see that deer. He shot that deer at almost 500 yards. He had a fixed four-power scope. He had old eyes even in the 80s. He was a Korean War vet. This obsession with high power magnification is a modern thing, and it generally is a thing that is held in high regard by people that only shoot off of benches. When you see people that actually go out and hunt on a regular basis, and I'm not talking South Texas box blind hunting, which, by the way, you also don't need any high mag for, because usually you're sitting with a feeder 100 to 120 yards away with a dead rest. But you look at people that go out in the timber and go in the high timber in the edge of the line to hunt elk, you do not see them running around with 16 power, 20 power scopes and shit like that. Generally, you're looking 3x9 or lower with people that actually use the weapon to do what was intended with it. I'm not lecturing anybody there. You can do whatever you want. I'm just reinforcing what he had to say. Let's go on and take another one. This one on training dogs and not getting overly frustrated when you do it and the bad things that happen if you let that occur.
Hello, TSP crew. This is Joel Riles with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again for another expert counsel segment. And today we're going to be talking about our dog training and some of the mistakes that people make when they're trying to work through some of the initial stuff they're doing with their dogs. We're actually going to have a small little series here about the biggest mistakes that I see handlers making when they're trying to train their dogs. So today we're going to be talking about not getting frustrated. Now, what often happens when we're training our dogs and we start to struggle or we have an issue with the dog and we start to get frustrated with the dog, the dog shuts down when we get frustrated, and basically anything you do with them from that point forward is going to be just a waste of time. They're not going to retain it nearly as well, and if you're not careful, you'll also start making your dog either hand shy or command shy, meaning they hear a command or they see you reaching for their lead, and they start to cower and pull back. They start to get nervous that there's going to be a correction. Now, the reason that happens a lot of times is because you're giving a command and you think that your command is clear, but the dog does not have a clear understanding of what you want them to do. So the first thing we need to do if we're having issues with our dogs following a command is make sure that our communication to the dog is as clear as it can possibly be. Now, if you're doing these commands and your dog's not following them, stop thinking the dog should know what they're supposed to do, why aren't they doing it, and start thinking, what am I doing wrong that is not communicating what I want the dog to do clearly to them, right? Just because you think it's clear does not mean that it's clear to the dog. Remember, you're thinking from a human perspective with a much higher capability of logic and reason and processing power. The dog's minds are very, very simple. And so sometimes you have to break the problem down into something super simple so that the dog has a very clear understanding of what it is, and then when they get that, you can start stepping it back up again. So the first thing to be aware of is make sure that your communication is very clear. The other thing that will happen sometimes is we will raise or lower our vocal, and this is often the pitch of our vocal, right? So we'll be trying to get our dog to do a command, and we'll say we're teaching a puppy how to sit, and we go seats, and for the first time, the puppy actually puts its butt down all by itself. I don't have to use the lead, and I go, oh, good seats. And I raise the vocal, or the pitch of my vocal. The dog gets all excited, lifts its butt off the ground. Now I have to correct the dog again, even though they were doing something that was really good, right? So what I'll do in these situations is I show a slightly increased level of excitement without raising the pitch of my tone. And I'll go, so a normal dog that knows how to sit, I go, seats, they sit down, I go, good seats. With a puppy, if they're trying to learn and I want to give a little bit of extra encouragement, I go, seats, and they sit, and I go, oh, good seats, and I'll give them some extra petting, and I will often have my hand just under their chin as I'm rubbing up and down their neck as a reward, and I'm using my other hand to rub on top of their head and between their ears, and that way if they start to sit up just a little bit, I can just take the hand that's under their chin and lift up slightly, and that will encourage them to put their butt back on the ground. Now, if they do start to get out of position, I freeze my hands, they stop petting the pup, and I lift up. As soon as their butt goes back on the ground, I continue petting, good seats, and so I do increase the excitement, quote unquote, just a little bit, but I don't raise the pitch of my voice very much. So I don't want the pitch of my voice to either get angry, and I don't want it to get overly excited. I want the pitch of my voice to stay calm and consistent throughout the process. So we don't want to get frustrated, and we don't want our pitch to get too high or low. Now, what I will do sometimes if I feel like the dog understands they're just not doing it, is I might increase the level of correction. So the two errors that people make when they're trying to teach their dog something, the first one is they're not communicating clearly, so the dog doesn't understand. If the dog does understand and they're still not doing it, it's because the correction when they don't do it is not hard enough. So we incrementally, by small amounts, will keep increasing the level of the correction until the dog does the thing, assuming that you're sure the dog knows what the command is. Now, if you want more details on how to show a dog how to do something, how to know and be sure that they actually understand what you're saying, that's all over at Canine Academy. You can go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. On the right-hand side, there's a banner for Canine Academy. Click on that. You'll go over, you can check out what we have, and you can sign up for the training over there, and we go into a lot more details on that. But do not get frustrated or overly excited by raising the pitch of your voice up too high or by getting an angry tone in your voice. Now, what happens if we're training our dog and we actually get frustrated, because we kind of can't help it if we start to get frustrated, right? What we do if we actually start to get frustrated with our pups or our dogs while we're training them is we just go put them away. We can put them in a crate. We can tie them out. We just have some chill time, right? Another option is if you're trying to teach your dog something new, but they already have some things that they do really well, well, stop trying to teach the new thing. Go over and do something that they do well for a little while. Let them get some praise. Let them get some rewards. Let them be like, woo, yeah, I'm doing something good. And then come back over after, say, 10, 15 minutes and then start working the new thing again. Or take a day break. Like, go over, do something new or something that they do good. Get them some praise. End the training session for the day, because we always want to end on a good note if we can. And then tomorrow when we start training, we'll start the new thing again and we'll keep working that. Start to get a little frustrated, go over, do something that they do good. And so that will really, really help as you're going through this. So I want to keep the tone of my voice very calm. I want to make sure I'm communicating very clearly. And if I know that the dog understands what I'm telling them to do, I need to make sure that I increase the level of correction, meaning the pop. And I do that incrementally until the dog responds, but I don't get frustrated or have an angry vocal while I'm doing it. Because what I don't want to do is create a fear response in the dog where they're like, oh crap, I'm in trouble. I just want them to know that wasn't what I wanted you to do. You need to do what I told you to do. Give the correction. Everything is very flat on the emotional scale. And then when they do the thing, good job, praise, maybe a little touch, a little pat on the head. And then we move on and we do other things. So do not get frustrated with your dogs, and always remember your ABTs. Always be training. Everything that you do with your dog is training. So sometimes you'll work your sessions and the dogs will be doing what they're supposed to do, and then you go in the house and you lose it all because you have a lower expectation in the house. Everything you do with your dog all day long, every time you interact with them, you are training your dog. If you allow them to do something you don't want, you're training them to do that thing more. If you correct for something when they're not supposed to do it, you're encouraging them to do it less. If you praise them when they do the things you want, you're definitely encouraging more of those good behaviors. Always be training with your dogs and continue doing that. Don't get frustrated. Take your breaks if you need to. There's not a rush. We're looking for improvement, not perfection. I hope that's helpful for you. If you want more information or more details on how to train your dogs to do specific things, check out Canine Academy. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Look on the right-hand side. There's a banner for Canine Academy. You can click on that and check out our website and sign up for our training. If you're looking for a fully trained protection dog or fully obedience trained dog, check out fortresscanine.com. We actually have two or three dogs that my previous trainer messed up for bite work. She overcorrected them when they were puppies for biting at her legs. And so they're not doing great in their bite work, but they're awesome dogs and they're going to be great family dogs. So we have a couple dogs available as fully obedience trained dogs right now. If you're looking for something like that, go over to fortresscanine.com and do the consult form, reach out to me, and we will have a conversation about how we can help you out. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
Completely agree with everything, Aaron. I'll tell you, one of my struggles in training Belle was the last dog that I trained before her was Charlie. Lucy, we took her in off the street. She was already an adult. My standards for her were pretty low. Don't bite people that we let in. Don't eat the ducks. Don't shit in the house. Sit when I tell you to sit. Stay when I tell you to stay. And that's pretty much it. Like, that was all I wanted out of her, because I knew with where she was and what her background was and having to basically fend for herself as like semi-feral, that it probably wasn't going to happen anyway. So if I could get that out of her, which I was able to, and it was actually remarkably easy, that I would be good. And I was also dealing with an older dog at that point. She was probably a year and a half, 2 years old. So she was out of that puppy freak out stage, right? Charlie, once he was just the typical hunting breed. Even though he was part pit bull, he was a pit bull pointer mix. And most of the hunting breeds, once they're, you know, like your retrievers and what have you, once they understand, this is the same thing with German shepherds, not necessarily working line shepherds with the high drive, but your typical German shepherd. Once that animal realizes what you're asking, they want to do it for you. Training him was immensely easy. Immensely easy. I had him, by the time he was the age that Belle is, he was already to the point where I could communicate with him in sentences. And you say it's a command, not a request, but I could literally say, hey, will you go do this for anybody? And he'd just go do it. When I went to try to train a high-drive dog, I had a lot of these frustration issues that Joel's talking about, and I tried to work through them the best that I could, and eventually it worked itself out. But I completely agree. And I'll just caution some of you that think you've really got this down, that when you bring the next dog in, especially if you had that dog for a long time, even some of the things that were difficult you kind of forget, and you expect this dog to become like your old dog really quick, and it takes time. You're training a child, and if you look at it that way, 2 years to invest in training a dog to where you have a good dog that obeys you, does what you ask him to do, good citizen on the homestead, protects your animals, protects your family. That's a small investment. Try that shit with a kid in 2 years and see where you get. That'll put it in perspective for you. Try it with a five-year-old. Invest two more years in a five-year-old till they're seven and see if you get them to that level by the seven. Good luck. Anyway, with that, let's talk about some gardening topics with Nick Ferguson.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with an expert counsel answer for Jake on drywall for garden soil amendments and also for Katie on mulberries. I've got a twofer today because they're both kind of short. The first one, question is, drywall gypsum a good soil amendment for gardens? Details, after a recent remodeling project, I have a number of scrap drywall pieces that are going to the dump. My contractor has mentioned multiple times the benefits of adding gypsum to garden soil. Google AI seems to agree with his sentiment. Is it worth the trouble? Is there an amount that is too much? Are there other chemicals present in drywall to cause concern? Thanks, Jake. Just no. I certainly wouldn't do it. First off, is it just plain drywall with no paint, just like scrap stuff that didn't get used? Is it regular drywall? Does it have antifungal ingredients in it? Is it, does it have extra fiberglass in it? All of these questions spring to mind. What kind of gypsum is it? Is it basically a synthetic gypsum? So, Yeah, so like if it has no paint, then maybe, but I still wouldn't. Some drywall, like I said, has antifungal ingredients. That's not good for gardens. I don't want that stuff in my garden. Some is made with fly ash from coal power plants, and sometimes that stuff has mercury and lead in it, so I wouldn't want to run the risk of that. If it's painted, then definitely not. I don't want paint in my garden. So here's my thing. A 50-pound bag of agricultural gypsum is so dang cheap, why risk contaminating your garden with possible heavy metals or antifungals or fiberglass? It's just not worth it, in my opinion. I'd check your soil and use ag gypsum if you need it. Second reason not to. If you're asking this question, then you probably aren't a soil nerd and you don't know what your soils actually need. Gypsum could actually lower your pH, your soil pH, more than it needs to be, which could in turn bind up minerals that your plants need. It, you know, I'm not trying to be snarky here or nasty about this, but it's kind of like finding a bottle of prescription pills and wondering if you should eat them without knowing if you even need the stuff inside the bottle for optimal health. So, now, I'd skip the garbage, I'd put the stuff in the landfill, in the dump, get a good soil test done with Logan Labs, not your local ag extension agency, and I would find out if you need gypsum. If you do, then buy a good bag of the stuff and just apply it at a responsible rate according to your tested levels and what you actually need on your soil to get the effects that you need with the gypsum. I'd never suggest people just add singular minerals like that unless you know what the effect is going to be. That's my main, honestly, that's probably my biggest concern with this, is knowing the actual quantity that you're putting out there, and then dealing with all the extra junk is just kind of like the icing on the cake of nope. Next question is, I'm hoping to propagate mulberry trees from cuttings of some local trees, and I want to confirm if the cuttings must come from female trees. Reaching out to Nick Ferguson for advice. Thanks. Then here's the details. We have a number of large mulberry trees on our property, but unfortunately they're not bearing any fruit. Just down the road there are 3 mature trees that are loaded with berries. I'm guessing that the trees on my property are male and the fruit-bearing trees down the road are female. That's a good guess. I'm hoping to propagate from cuttings and assume I need to select from the female trees if I expect to have berries. Thanks for your help, Katie. I'm trying so hard to keep my when a mommy tree and a daddy tree jokes to myself, but you can probably follow my line of thinking. If you want some fruit, the only place you're going to get that from is a female tree. Mulberries are either monoecious or dioecious, and that means they either make both male and female flowers, or they make one or the other. Some will only make female flowers, some only make male flowers, some make them both on the same tree. Now, typically, the female-only trees produce more fruit because all the flowers are going towards fruit creation. They can only make so many flowers. So, if your trees never produce fruit, it could be that they're female with no pollinating male flowers in close proximity, or it could be that they're male trees and they're only making pollen. So, there's no real way for me to tell with the information that I have. Typically, the male flowers look fluffier in the springtime, and then they dry up and just fall off. The female flowers look rounder and more full when they are an early flower before they start making fruit. So you can tell by just looking at them, but you have to know what you're looking for, kind of. So if you root cuttings of known fruit producers, you are most likely going to get fruit from those trees once they're mature. Here's because either they're dioecious and they're going to produce both, which means you're going to get fruit, or they're females. And if your problem is you just have female trees over there and no males, if you're taking them from multiple trees, the odds are one of those trees is going to be dioecious if all three of those are producing fruit. It's pretty good odds that one of them is going to be dioecious. But here's the cool thing. You can actually graft, assuming that the trees that you have that aren't producing fruit are male, you can actually graft female scion onto those presumably male trees, and you can prune the trees to promote the dominance of the female limb and then turn the established root system into a fruiting tree way faster, and you can have essentially, let's just assume that these mulberry trees are 20 years old. In like 3 or 4 years, you can have basically a 23-year-old, 24-year-old mulberry tree that will be producing like a tree that old because it has this massive root system and this new female branch that's going to be producing fruit. I'm actually working on a line of male-only trees for those who are worried about purple bird poo on their cars, but you still want the amazing protein content in the leaves for animals. So that's exciting. I'm looking forward to being able to provide those to people. Thanks for the great questions, everyone. Keep them coming. I'm Nick Ferguson with HomegrownLiberty.com. Do good things.
I think the mulberry advice is what it is, and it's good enough. I'll just add on to the whole using drywall gypsum and as a soil. No, I agree with Nick. Just don't do it. Just don't do it. You're not really saving much money either, because the proper product, an ag grade gypsum, is not that expensive, especially at like a homestead scale. And I also agree with the concept that you should at least know what you're doing to your soil. I won't put it as bluntly as he did, like you're finding a bottle of prescription pills and just taking them because, well, they must be good for something. But these amendments have effects on the soil. If you don't have a baseline and know that you want to move in the direction of the effect, you could be moving in the absolute wrong direction. There's a lot of people would say it's good to lime your soil. Well, come do that in a place where your soil is already a pH of like, 8.2, 8.3, or 7.8 even. Like, you don't want to do that. Ask me how I know. Moving on, let's talk about old man's beard.
Hey, TSP community. Gary Brown here from Stronger Roots Resources. And we're in the middle of February, having a snow day today, actually. And a few days prior, we had quite the windstorm. Anytime it's windy, especially this time of year, go out underneath your oak trees and some of your other large hardwood trees. Pretty good chance that you are going to find, fallen on the ground or possibly still attached to small branches, a lichen. Regionally, it's known as old man's beard, also Usnea, also sometimes pronounced Usnea. Just the same, this is a kind of a light sage green lichen that has tons of healing properties. I'll get to those in just a minute. But if you want to be sure about your ID, when you pull it apart, you should see kind of a white elastic string emerge, and you'll know that you're working with the right variety here. So this is one of these things that a lot of people overlook, and then others are really, really stoked when they find it, because it is such a useful I keep wanting to call it a plant, but it's a lichen. So just very, very useful species. Habitat is going to be heavily under, it grows on trees. You're not going to find this growing on the ground. If you find it on the ground, it's probably blown off, or it's still attached to a branch. And when you find it on the ground, that's actually the most sustainable way to collect it. It's also a good sign about the health of your environment. This is not something that grows well in heavily polluted environments, so you've kind of got that environmental indicator going on. So medicinal uses, long list. I'll kind of hit the highlights here. Antibacterial and antiviral. It contains eosinic acid, which is effective against bacterial infections, especially those affecting the respiratory and urinary systems. For wound care, it can be crushed or powdered And apply directly to wounds as an antiseptic. So consider that for your go bags and your, you know, your wild land medicine kits. Immune support can be taken as a tincture or tea to support the immune system during cold and flu season. Also used for lung and throat health, for sore throats, bronchitis, pneumonia, and things of that nature. It's at its most potent when you do an extraction via an alcohol based tincture, and there's several places out there on the World Wide Web that can give you step-by-step instructions for that. For quick use, you can steep it in hot water as a tea or an infusion, and then as a poultice or powder, you can dry it up, grind, you know, kind of do a fine grind for easy packaging, and you can use that externally on your wounds. So there is a little bit of evidence that eusenic acid can be hard on the liver, so take that into account if you have anything else compromising your liver. And just like anything, you know, do your research, know how it affects your body, but it's one of those that is tends to be readily available. Find it pretty regularly around here in my region. Like I said, especially when it's been windy, it just seems to be one of those things that that's provided this time of year when the winds really kick up. So, hope that's useful to you. That's Eusnea, old man's beard, whatever you want to call it. Cool little guy to add to your homestead or your travel first aid kit. So, thank you guys so much. Let me know if I can help you out with any of your foraging needs. StrongRootsResources@gmail.com. And we'll talk to you next time.
There's a show I like. I think it's called Uncharted with Gordon Ramsay. And it's all theatrical, some of the stuff they put him through. But there is an episode where he goes to Alaska. And this guide has him climb this crazy-ass cliff face to get some old man's beard. And the whole time I'm watching, I'm like, this is all bullshit. I mean, this stuff's not hard to get your hands on at all. You don't have to climb this dangerous rock face. The only thing that made it somewhat realistic is later in that episode, another person that he was working with told him, oh, that stuff is everywhere. And he looked pretty incensed. So either it was some truth to pulling a joke on him, or he's a better actor than you'd think. He's not just a chef. He's a good actor. But if you ever want to check out a really cool show, honest to God, Uncharted with Gordon Ramsay, there is some cooking theatrics in it. He's always cooking for some dignitary or some shit. And like, it's always, oh, I hope I don't mess it up. And it's all hype. But there's some really cool places and some really cool experiences and some really cool ideas for what to do with food, and a really kind of a deep understanding of some ways that other people in the world cook that is pretty interesting. And he, like I said, he's pretty good as a character in a show like that. All right, next up, and he's never like calling people idiot sandwich or something in that show either. It's kind of cool to see him a little bit humbled, honestly. Next up, we have something called Miracle Berry from Chef Ken Daniels. Check this one out. I think you'll dig it.
Hello all, Ken with DrinkEatLearn.com and BloodSugarChef.com. Right now, my life has been focused on my physical recovery and improving my lifestyle living with type 2 diabetes. I've been dedicated to this keto, partial ketovore diet for almost 2 weeks now. I've cut out almost all my carbs, absolutely zero sugars, and I haven't eaten anything processed or boxed in 2 weeks. And man, my glucose numbers have been great. It's absolutely working. And the one problem I still have right now are these damn cravings. I am a carb and sugar addict. Now, I hope these things will get easier, and I know the detox from the carbs and sugars are needed. I'm still tempted every time I'm jonesing for something sweet, though. I try to rationalize and find a bit of a sugar-free this or a box of processed that, but it's just not worth it, right? I look at my injured eye and I remind myself it's just not worth it. Plus, I've been feeling great, and I can't stop now. But damn, I still want a cookie. So, I had an idea. A few years back, while researching obscure ingredients in my food and beverage industry, I stumbled across something that seemed whimsical at the time, but now it may be a hack to not only help me kick my cravings for sweets, but also keep me in ketosis. It's something I wanted to share with you today. It's something called the Miracle Berry. This natural berry has the ability to configure your taste buds, making sour foods taste sweet without adding a single gram of sugar or carbs. So, Imagine eating a lemon and it tastes like lemonade, or a tart berry and it suddenly becomes like candy, or vinegar that drinks like honey. Sounds insane? It kind of is. So before we get into how this thing hijacks your taste buds, let's talk about where it actually comes from. The miracle berry, officially known as Cynips palum dulcificum, it is native to West Africa and where it's been used for centuries. The indigenous people would chew the berries before eating otherwise sour or bitter foods. Things like unripe fruit, bitter roots, or even fermented porridge. It wasn't just for fun, it was survivalism. It was a practical way to make food more palatable without adding sugar and helped otherwise starving families survive. The name itself, Miracle Berry, is pretty modern. The first Western accounts of this fruit come from a French explorers around the 18th century. They noticed that locals would eat these berries before meals to enhance flavor. The name Miracle comes from its almost magical ability to transform taste buds. But in reality, at this time, these guys didn't know exactly the science behind what was going on. The Miracle Berry contains this protein called miraculin. The compound was first isolated and named in 1968 by this Japanese researcher named Kenzo Kurahara. Scientists had known about the berry's effect for centuries, but until Kurahara's research, they didn't fully understand the protein responsible for altering the taste perception. So instead of calling it something like acid receptor modifier, Kurahara went with this miraculin to reflect its seemingly magical effect. So here's what's actually happening. Normally, your taste buds detect sour flavors from acid, like citric acid in lemons, or acetic acid in vinegar. But when miraculin binds to your tongue, it messes with those receptors, so instead of tasting sour, your brain suddenly interprets that acidity as sweet. The effect kicks in about a minute after eating the berry and lasts for somewhere around 30 minutes to an hour, depending on your body chemistry. But here's the best part. It doesn't add sugar, so if you're doing keto, low carb, or just cutting sugar, this berry is an absolute cheat code for satisfying craving. Some examples of foods that taste amazing, so like lemons and limes, like they taste like fresh squeezed lemonade with no sugar added. Apple cider vinegar or lemon water, this is how I actually kind of get like a soda-like drink. Goat cheese and feta, they kind of take the tang off of it and make it something more like cheesecake. The best thing I've ever done with this as a chef, I've done a Carolina black peppered pulled pork with a Carolina vinegar sauce. It gave the pork a sweet and hot taste without the sugar. Really, the sky's the limit, and if you want more recipes, go check out my websites, right? But basically, any food that has natural acidity gets a full flavor transformation. And that means you can start satisfying your sugar craving without breaking ketosis just by using foods that you're already eating. It's not some miracle cure for food cravings, but it's an insanely useful tool if you know how to use it right. All right, so if you're ready to try this for yourself, where do you actually get it? The actual fresh berries are pretty rare because they don't really last long, so most people use Miracle Berry tablets. These are just freeze-dried berries pressed into a dissolvable form. You can find them on Amazon, different size of packs, but they all average a cost about $1.80 per tablet. How do you use it? You grab a dissolvable tablet, you place it on your tongue, and you let it fully dissolve. You just don't chew it, just let it coat your taste bud. You wait about a minute for it to take effect, and then you start trying some acidic food and watch how your brain freaks out. The effect lasts for about 30 minutes to an hour, depending on how much saliva you produce. Also, I've noticed the more you drink, it also washes it away, so take that into account. I remember when I first tried it years ago, my mind was blown. I had done a private tasting event where I had everyone pop these tablets in their mouth and did different recipes to screw with people's perception of taste. The event was great, but I totally forgot about these little suckers, right? So for me, the Miracle Berry has helped twice now that I've been doing this keto life. I've been cutting out sweets, cold turkey, but for this segment, I wanted to give it a try again, and it worked. I love key lime pie. I did a key lime cream cheese mousse, and I'll leave the recipe for it with Jack, and I'm still keeping my portions small, but it really did the trick. I chilled it, and it was delicious. So I'd like to think of it as an aid to step down from the sugar addiction. I view it as kind of like a nicotine gum for smokers. It helps curb the cravings until I can wean myself off the sugar highs of my past. I don't think you should be popping these berries every night, but I wanted to share this little odd berry that probably most of you have never heard of. For me, this is a modern food survivalist tool. And if you're struggling like me, which I know many of you are considering all the emails, this could be one of the easiest ways to trick your brain into thinking you're eating something sweet without adding carbs or calories. And instead of relying on artificial sweeteners or fighting through your cravings, you can enjoy natural flavors of real food, but with a totally different experience. And if you have any questions for me, please look me up. Check me out at drinkeatlearn.com and my new site, bloodsugarchef.com. So until next time, this is Ken. Cheers.
Well, I'm going to give this a go. This is something, like I said, I knew about this almost 20 years ago, and I just never grew it, never tried it. I will tell you that I think there is something to the fact that a lot of these foods that it makes taste sweet, It's less that it makes them taste sweet, and it's more what he was saying about it prevents the perception of the sour, the tart, the bitter. And here's why. A lemon actually has a significant amount of sugar in it. So does lime. But it has so much acetic acid that it tastes sour. And the way you can determine this for yourself really quick is make some orange mead. If you make orange mead, of course, then you take the sugars that are in both the honey and the orange, and you ferment them out so the sweet is gone, especially if you use a really high attenuating yeast. And an orange mead is quite sour once you remove the sugar. So a lime is quite sweet once you remove the sour. So I'm not sure that it would make all sour things taste sweet, but it would certainly prevent any sour thing from tasting truly sour. Now, exactly what that tastes like, I'm not going to know until we try it. Because one of the things, if you think about something like totally indulgent, like a key lime pie, or in Ken's case, key lime mousse, which I have the recipe for in the show notes today, the juxtaposition between the sour and the sweet is what really makes it great. But if this stuff makes lemon taste sweet and it still tastes like lemon, my wife's going to love that. We'll be sending shit to Ken to thank you for it, because my wife is a lemon freakazoid. She just loves lemon more than anything else in the world. If it's sweetened lemon, that is. So I'm going to give this a try. And they are kind of expensive. Now, what I did, I went and looked up for you. This is in the show notes today, right under Ken's key lime mousse recipe. Went to Amazon, and I kind of did a deep dive on all the different brands, and I found the one that seems to have the highest rating that also is not fake reviews. And I have a link to where you can get a twin pack of it, because it saves some money to buy two pack, like he said, instead of one. So he might have ended up settling on the same brand that I did, which would just reinforce that it's a good one. So if you want to give it a try, you can. But I wanted to say one more thing about this before I go into my segment. Okay, it's good to be able to do things like this. And I've used things like mixes of monk fruit and stevia to sweeten certain things and all. But I challenge you, if you need to do what Ken's doing right now, which is break an addiction and use it like methadone, fine. But try eating as many things as you can with no added sweetener. And what will happen is, instead of hacking your taste perception will change. An example for me is I drink coffee, you know, 4 or 5 cups a day of coffee, and I always use whole cream in it. Just a tablespoon of whole cream to a big cup of coffee, to me, tastes like the coffee's been sweetened. There's a certain amount of residual lactose, which is a sugar, a non-digestible sugar, by the way, in cream. And that little tiny hint of sweetness that when I first cut all sweetener out of my coffee, I was like, man, this is kind of bitter. I need a little bit more cream. But within a couple weeks, I can't stomach anything being added to sweetened coffee. A single drop of stevia tastes to me like somebody put 4 tablespoons in it, like a dadgone Dunkin' Donuts coffee. So I'm just going to say, if you'll stop sweetening things altogether, all of a sudden your perception will change. With that, let's talk about my subject today. And I don't want to go deep into this. There may be an episode that has this as part of it where we go deeper into it. But I've noticed something, and I heard somebody say something, and then it expanded in my head as to what that might actually mean. But Gen Z men and women are showing very divergent voting habits. And it's more evident in places like Germany, where it's not a two-party system, it's a 4, 5, 6-party system. So you generally have, in those types of governments, parties that are very, very right, very conservative, and very, very liberal. And you don't have a lot of variance within the parties like we do. You have Democrats in our Senate that are more in line with a Republican than they are with extreme ends of their own party, because there's no other place for them to go. There's that line in the middle of the uniparty, and either you identify as uniparty A or uniparty B, if you get what I'm saying. So when we look at the variance between voting in the United States between men and women, it's not that clear. You know, do you have a man and a woman that look like, you know, one's Democrat, one's Republican, but they're only, like, let's say, in a 100-degree situation, only 10 degrees of separation. They're both just off the center. where when we look at the results that came in, like from Germany, and then we break it down to the demographic, these are Gen Z males and females. The Gen Z males are on the far right spectrum, and the Gen Z females are on the far left. So it's not that they're center of two different parties and close together. They're widely divergent. And it's in the range of like 80% of each going off in that direction. Okay, this creates an incompatible situation. There's a lot of shit that a guy will deal with out of a woman because he thinks she's pretty and he, I can accept these things and we don't have to agree on everything and all. But when you're talking the wackadoodle that is the modern woke, they're not going to tolerate it. They're just not. Okay, and then the other side of it is when you get these women that are, you know, anything that they don't like is, you know, taking away their their autonomy over their body, right? You know, like, you get these women that are like, it wouldn't matter for the male anyway, but like, this is like a triple-duper lesbian, and she's worried about the ability to have an abortion. Like, there's a disconnect with reality there. And some of this other nonsense, like women in men and women's sports, and letting men into bathrooms and things like that. Like, they're not going to tolerate, I said the man won't tolerate them, but they're not going to tolerate that dude either. That's like, you're freaking retarded. I don't, like, they're like oil and water. They're going to separate. Well, the problem with that leaves the woke woman with about 20% of the dudes to choose from. And let's be honest, the vast majority of them are very beta. And that may work for some of the domineering women and all, but like, do you want to have to earn all the money in the household or whatever? Because a lot of these guys are just, they're imps, right? They're simps. The other side of it is a lot of those guys can't initiate a conversation with a woman either. So now that the wokies have to fight for the woke dudes. Now, if you think I'm just picking on the woke women here, no, because see, now you got they call them, you know, the based boys, right? They only have like 20% of the women that they all have to compete for. And a bunch of them are like, I don't want to, they've seen what's happened to their parents. And they've seen their dads have like lose half their shit, end up paying child support for most of their lives while mom was shacking up with some other dude. And they're paying alimony. And they've seen how stacked against men the system really is. And so a lot of them are part of that whole Met Gal thing, men going their own way. Okay, what this ends up with is you end up in a situation where you already have a declining population in the West. This is only going to make that worse. We already have women waiting until they're older to have children, and that age keeps getting pushed up. And now you create this divergent thing. But there's another way to look at this. What is one of the highest, most contentious issues among these two groups? Borders. And this was the one, I don't remember if I heard this in a Paul Joseph Watson thing or something else, or it was somebody that, you know, was on one of those Paul Watson videos. But they said the borders thing is interesting in this dynamic because generally the conservative right want to close the national border and the liberal left want to open the border with no restrictions at all. But there was something said in that kind of went to another. How many places is it about borders? We don't think it's about borders. Saying that men should not go into a female bathroom is a border. It's a border. Saying that it's okay if you want to be a dude that dresses like a woman and go around acting like a woman, but I will not say that you're a woman is a border. And being willing to say that they are something we know they are not is an open border. You see what I'm saying here? There's so many of these political issues that when you drill right down to them, there's a line, a border, that the typical rational, logic-led person refuses to allow to be taken down. And the person that's led emotionally wants taken down. And the people that want the border taken down are not always wrong in their logic, I want to say. Like, the little thread of logic that's in there is that This is often what tyrants use to keep people divided, are these artificial borders. So the problem is when you correct that problem, people tend to overcorrect. Like, I was always a proponent of allowing gay people to get married, and I still am. I don't care what your religious beliefs are. I don't give a shit. It doesn't matter to me. And I don't care about all the other things that could happen because of it. Those are separate issues. If two people that are adults that happen to be the same sex want to legally bond themselves to each other in a voluntary ceremony, that should be okay. That's fine. And when we use that, and the right can be just as emotionally stupid, you know, emotionally led and stupid as the left, it's not as often, but it can be just as bad, and you think an objection to that is, well, God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Not everybody shares your religious belief, and maybe you're wrong about it anyway. I don't know. Right? I'm not going to tell you what your religious belief really is. That's up to you to determine. But that's not a logical argument. It just isn't. So most people that are considered right-wing conservatives have a border, but they also have an admissions policy, if you want to look at it that way. Like, we're for immigration, just legal, right? You want to be gay, be gay. You want to talk about your gayness to a five-year-old, that's not okay. You see what I'm saying? The border needs not to be impenetrable for most issues. It just needs to be enforced. And the left believes that the border needs to go away because it doesn't feel right. So now that we as soon as you walk that path, you start heading toward insanity. So because the people that want to control you were successful in putting some of these borders up to an unreasonable level, which is this person that wants to live like a woman, even though they're a dude, should be thrown off a ship into the ocean or something. Then the overcorrection was, well, then everything's okay. And we're literally at the edge right now where we have some people that think we just need to change pedophile into minor attracted person. No, because there's also some borders that should be hardcore and unyielding. Person that wants to have sex with a child, and I'm not talking about a 19-year-old dude that gets a blowjob from a 16-year-old girl that have been going out with each other for a year. We can go overboard with that, but you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a dude, an adult, trying to have sex with a legitimate child. Okay, the only place that person needs to go is in a wood chipper. That's it. I'm thinking that or a trebuchet, launching them off into shark land or something, right? Like, there's some that should not be crossed, but most people, even very right-leaning, conservative-type people, or ANCAP libertarians would say, but we also need to make a place in society for those people to be left alone. This is the real divide. It's about these borders. But there's another side to this. Generally speaking, I think people have a very skewed image of who has more influence in society. And they tend to want to believe it's women. Women, single moms are heroes that don't wear capes. Women can do anything a man can do. Women power, feminism, and even the good kind of feminism, the original feminism of just simply, hey, we want equal rights, okay, all the way to the extreme lunatic feminism, right? There's just a desire by many for this, like, superwoman mentality. But in the end, it's a fiction. I know some of you are going to be mad, and remember, we're talking about averages today. So there's probably 20% of women in general that what I'm about to say about women doesn't apply to, mostly. But even that group, some of it does. And that is this. How many women work for the sewer department in the where you lift manholes and go down in the sewer? How many? For all the talk of equal rights and all this shit, we need more women, and we need more women flying airplanes or whatever. How many women are doing that job? And if we threw all the DEI equal rights bullshit at just that one thing, like, the number wouldn't go up because they don't want to do it. If you look at the ground-pounding hard work, the blue-collar work, welding, fabrication, garbage truck driver, okay? The person that frames a house, that works 12 hours a day all summer long framing houses. The person that carries bricks up a ladder and then throws them to the guy on the top of the scaffolding to lay the bricks, right? You look at all of the things that keep the people that drive the trucks that put gas in tanks that you pump gas out of into your tank. When you take your car to get the oil changed. The person that works for Ford or Chevy, GM, etc., but they don't work in an office doing HR shit or computer programming, the person that's on the assembly line bolting the fucking tire on the car, okay? The person that unloads the truck that brings all the shit to the warehouse. Women, yes, in some levels do some of these jobs, but these jobs are 90% men, at least. Some of them far more so. And if a lot of the jobs that both men and women do, including jobs that are high paying, and I would call them good jobs, and even many that are, you know, useful in some way, but if we just stopped doing them, nothing really would change. And in a lot of places where something would change, if you remove the regulations that require those jobs to exist, nothing would change. In other words, we need all these administrators for this industry to run, but we really don't need it for it to run. We need it to satisfy regulatory climate. I'm going to tell you something that's going to really upset some of you, and I'm sorry, but it's true. We could probably eliminate about 80% of what women do in the workforce. And if we got rid of the reasons many of those jobs have to be there. In other words, we don't need as many, like even in like a place where women are, there's a lot of women employed that are doing the real work too, like teaching. School teachers are mostly women. When I say mostly, 51% would be mostly, okay? School teachers are mostly women, especially, let's say, 8th grade and below, incredibly female-dominated. So the school teacher that teaches 3rd grade, 4th grade, 5th grade, whatever, for all the ways you think I dislike them, I don't. They're doing the real work. The sheer number of administrators in the school system is all about regulation, compliance, and programs for equity and other bullshit. If you got rid of everybody in that school that didn't teach, you kept the janitor and the maintenance worker, the school would still be able to run. It probably is good that they have like a principal, vice principal, and maybe one lady answer the phone in the office. But you could clear out 20-30% of the workforce, and it wouldn't matter. And guess what? Most of those people in that 20-30% are women. Women have occupied in the workplace a whole lot of positions that are make work. And it doesn't mean what you do is bad. It doesn't mean that I hate you. It doesn't mean that you're not necessary in the current system, to be clear. But the system is a construct, right? The system is not actually designed to make sure, let's say, that children get educated. It's designed to make sure that the educational system is controlled. And as long as you have these required positions, then you're necessary to fill that hole. Why does this matter to this issue? Because when it comes to finally saying enough the fuck is enough, God, I know you're going to hate this, but what traditionally has led to the belief that women can control men is sex. But in the end, there's a point where dudes are like, I'm not having this shit anymore. And if you want all the things that we provide, then we're not having this shit anymore. And you can see this in some of the Survivor-like things, how real this is. So like Bear Grylls did this in a UK version of Survivor. There was like a Dutch version where they took the two groups of like 14 dudes and 14 chicks, and they put them on different parts of the island, and like you have your own tribe. And the reason women have all this trouble is because of the patriarchy, yeah? And the patriarchy, if women were, everything would be better. Okay, well, there's no patriarchy to blame. Here, 14 women, go figure your shit out. And in 2 weeks, the dudes created like a little mini Club Med. They were hanging out, they were fishing, they had built their huts, they were, you know, continuing to build huts, so they had enough huts for everybody to have their own. They were basically just dudes fishing, hunting, and building shit, and they were all fucking happy. And the women were fighting with each other and attacking each other and miserable and crying and couldn't make a fire and never even built one hut. And they were starving to death. They eventually had to merge things. This is where it got interesting. When they did merge things, the men ended up doing all the grunt work and the women were laying around happy again, getting suntans. Now, I know that some of you might be real upset with me and think that I'm being misogynist right now. This is what happened. This isn't what I think. This was the result. And the reality is that the majority of jobs that are freaking necessary for comfort to exist in the world are done by men. And one of my best friends put it this way, and my wife and his wife were there when he did, and they both agreed. I'm not saying that you guys are not better people than we are, but the world you live in exists because of people like us. The fact that you can feel that way, think that way, and have the time to be that way is because there's others that do the hard work. Whether it's the guy that goes down in the ditch or the guy that makes sure the other guy goes in the ditch and gets the job done because he's an asshole boss. And that's a fundamental reality. Now, I think in this split, the Gen Z male has reached the point that men eventually reach, generationally I'm talking here. They're the hero generation in the fourth turning. I know that's hard to believe right now, but what you see on TikTok isn't reality. Go talk to a 22-year-old with a blue-collar job, and you'll see what I mean. And I think that when that bifurcation becomes terminal, that there's a reason that we have something that we think of as, I don't really believe it's a patriarchy, but what we think of as the patriarchy is because men do the hard shit. And if that reconciliation doesn't occur, the trade-off is going to be a demographic bomb like you can't imagine. Because young men seem to have reached the point where they're already having less kids. Marriage numbers are already down. There's a huge number of young men that already don't want anything to do with marriage because they don't want all the pain that can come with it in a system stacked against them. And if that's the alternative, and then you turn around and you're dealing with some blue hair who wants you to become a vegan because it's going to save polar bears, you ain't having it. And in the end, I think that when we get to a point where dudes are like, well, if you don't want all the shit we do, we just won't do it. I think that's where the reckoning comes. Maybe I'm wrong. And if this one upset you, I will actually say something I usually don't say when I upset people. I'm sorry that it upset you. I may not be the right person to explain this. I may not have enough of the soft in me to explain this the right way. But I challenge you, if you are upset with this, which happens all the time, and you're going to send me hate email, which happens all the time, most of which I just delete, then I'll challenge you with it this way. Do not use individual examples. I'm a woman, and I do this, and I work really hard, and I can keep up with any man with a nail gun or whatever. I acknowledge that. I acknowledge that. I'm okay with that. Do it with actual evidence based on anything that gets outside of me being able to generalize this, because I don't want what I'm saying to be true. I know that's hard to believe sometimes, but I don't want to be right about this. But I really feel like I am. And I really do think it comes down to borders. Borders are not just imaginary lines on a map between countries. Borders are what we allow into our lives and we allow into our minds. We need a border around our brain. And there are certain things that I feel like, I don't know if it's women's desire to please or women's desire. Like, you guys want to get along, but you fight all the time. It's a weird dynamic. Like, I can put 10 dudes on a job site together, and they'll all give each other shit all day long and then go out and have beers. Two of them can get in a fight on Wednesday, and they'll go have drinks together on Friday. I've worked in offices where we've had a significant number of women, and y'all are just terrible to each other. I'm sorry, you are. And again, my wife agrees with this because she's worked in those offices most of her working life. She's a nurse, surrounded by other women. Just hateful to each other. And it's a weird thing. It's like you guys want to get along and you want to make everybody happy, but then you're also just horrible to each other. And dudes just, okay, we had a fight. I said I'm sorry about the reason I got us in the fight. You said you're sorry. We shake hands, we go have a beer, we're fucking done with it. And if you want to know the real reason I think men control the world, that's the real reason. It's not that we'll go do the shit work, because the men that control the world don't do the shit work. Many men that control the world come up through shit work, but they don't stay doing it, or they're not in control of anything. I think there's a big disconnect in reality here. Women want to be perceived as cooperative, but men have a predisposition to be more cooperative with each other, to get along with the person you don't really like for the purpose that needs to be accomplished. Again, maybe I'm not the right person to explain that. I'd love to hear what you think about it. And do you think that we're heading off a population cliff? We already know that enrollment cliff is hitting us in education. And would you like to hear a show that goes into other things that connect back into this? Because we have some real societal problems today. And I think this is not the cause of it. This is the result. Anyway, with that, hope you enjoyed today's show. Tomorrow's episode will be a Friday flashback, and then next week we'll do it all again. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.